Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Saeeda Varsi.
Hello, I'm David Baddiel, and welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There. Now, we've got a bit of an international quality to the episode this week, partly because I'm in India, I'm in Mumbai, on a book tour. My children's books, Saeeda, they're huge in India. Who knew? And so I've been signing books and going to schools in India. But you're going to Pakistan, isn't that right, quite soon?
I am. In the next couple of days, I'm going to be in Pakistan. So it's a good time, really, to talk about, I think, India and Pakistan, partition, and the read across to Israel and Palestine. And we're also going to be talking about this phenomenon known as Christian Zionism.
Yeah.
But let's start with India, David. There's elections happening there. Give me your take.
I have been speaking a lot about it to Indians here who are keen to talk about it. Before we get on to what you call the read across to Israel, Palestine, which I think is very interesting, I'd like to know your feeling as a British person of Pakistani heritage and a Muslim about generally how you feel about the way that India's gone in the last few years and with Modi and with the sort of move towards Hindu nationalism and Hindu supremacy.
The concept of Hindu nationalism and Hindutva, this kind of ideology of Hindu supremacy, has been around since the kind of 1800s. Yeah. And it did play a part in the run-up to the independence of India and partition. So it was a movement against originally the British Raj. But it was because it was always bubbling under the surface that eventually it led to the creation of Pakistan, because the sense really was that Muslims would not be safe in this kind of independent India once the British had left, and that really Muslims of the Indian subcontinent needed their own homeland. So if you go back through the movement for independence, it was actually originally a secular movement with all religions and people of no faith all acting together for an independent India. Yeah. But I think more recently, before partition, it was felt by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, founder of Pakistan, and a group of other individuals from the Muslim community, that actually they did need their own homeland.
I feel we're pulling ourselves towards our core subject, and it is partly, and I think I suggested this subject, partly because I had what I thought was a revelation. It clearly isn't. It's clearly something that you've thought about before and other people have thought about before, but I haven't. And that is, I was talking to some Indians about partition, and yes, what you've just said is clearly the case, is that there were people at the time, Jinnah amongst them, who felt that the Muslims in the greater Indian subcontinent were not entirely safe within that situation and needed their own homeland that was a Muslim homeland. The carving up of what happened was then, of course, done by the British. There was much displacement and war as a result of that. And then you end up with these two states essentially at loggerheads with each other. But one is what you might call an ethno-state in which Muslims feel they are safe. Now, what does that remind you of?
Exactly. And interestingly, one of the things that I've talked about in the past is that there were all sorts of boundaries and borders that were created after the Second World War in the 1940s. Often the British, we had our hand in it, and often we screwed it up and left behind all sorts of challenges. And often we got out before we'd actually fixed the problem. And interestingly, both in the ongoing dispute in Kashmir and the dispute between India and Pakistan and the ongoing dispute in Israel and Palestine, it is because in the end we just cut and ran, rather than trying to do what we set out to do, which was to create these homelands for two peoples.
What's very clear from my reading of the history of both areas is that the British had this kind of absurd overconfidence or complacency that things would be fine once they left. All they needed to do was, yes, there were warring factions in these places, but we'll just give one faction this bit of land and one faction that bit of land, and then we'll leave, and everything will be absolutely fine. And it's incredible that what happens is they do that, they carve it up, and then there's enormous amounts of wars and bloodshed.
I think there was also a sense of, well, not our problem anymore, off we go. And if you look at the timings of both the partition of India, British India, and also what happened with the British Mandate in Palestine, there was a sense of there was an unfinished job left. This kind of rise of extreme nationalism within Hinduism, this ideology of Hindutva, was pushed back by Gandhi. Mm. And it was, interestingly, again, there's parallels, because Gandhi didn't want a divided nation. He wanted a greater secular India. But in the end, of course, there was an agreement of these two nations. He was, soon after partition, killed by a Hindu right-wing nationalist. Yeah. And interestingly, again, we find, for example, in Israel and Palestine, that when there was a moment for peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, and Yitzhak Rabin was a huge part of that, he, again, was killed by an extreme Jewish nationalist, a settler. Yeah. And so I think there has been this ongoing tension between a secular state and what is now increasingly becoming much more of an extreme nationalist state in India. And I think what I hear from British Indian friends is that in many ways, that they feel that their families took a decision, Indian Muslim families took a decision to remain in India, but now they are being othered. What British Indian Muslim friends now say is that nearly 80 years on from partition, when their families took a decision to remain in India, and many of the British Pakistani families took a decision to move, that did they make the wrong decision? And that is a really disturbing place, I think, for British Muslim Indians to find themselves in.
And the other thing that's very common is this sense that despite the fact that it's a country with 1.4 billion people in it, of which 200 million are Muslim, there is quite a strong sense, and I think this is interesting in terms of how grievance politics works, is that Modi and others tend to push an idea somehow. Again, it's like the replacement theory, that Hindus are being suppressed, even in a country as populous with Hindus as this. So Modi did a speech quite recently in which he talked about infiltrators, and he referred to how the previous government, the Congress, had said that first resources needed to go to minorities, and that was identified as being Muslim. I mean, you see it all the time, I think, in Israel-Palestine, the ways in which people want to win arguments and they want to win political positions often involves not trying to claim a sort of victory, but trying to claim grievance, trying to claim that they are the ones who are being suppressed, they're the ones who have less power. Obviously, we have this conversation quite a lot, and who occupies the space of the most marginalised. And I just found it very powerful here that because it's so populous, and because Hindus are, it seems to be so clearly, the dominant culture, that still, for the politics of grievance, there is a creation of a narrative that Hindus are being suppressed.
It is. And always you will find that extremism and extremist religious positions and nationalism, in the end, it's all about the politics. So this has been really the way in which the BJP, which is Modi's party, which is again rooted in an organization called the RSS, which in itself is an extremist movement, really. You could call it an extremist religious movement, which in the past has talked about its admiration for Hitler and Mussolini, that actually all of this in the end is about making a divide between this nationalistic BJP and this secular Congress, which is much more inclusive of minorities, Christian minorities, Sikh minorities, and other minorities as well. And it's politic, and then you referred to that speech. But I think what's interesting in India is the many ways in which there is now this othering of minorities, and particularly Muslims. So some of it is about temples and mosques. Some of it is about citizenship. So there have been some changes in the law recently, which basically others Muslim minorities, but not other minorities. Some of it is about food. And we've talked about it before, beef lynchings and the way in which the cow as an animal is considered to be sacred in Hinduism and in India. Some of it is about everyday living. So headscarf bans, marriage. I have lots and lots of friends and even members of the family who are intermarried between Hindus and Muslims. And traditionally, it had always happened in India. But now the term that now given to it when a Muslim marries a Hindu is love jihad. Where people are actually mixed religious couples are actually persecuted.
That's all absolutely true. There's two things that are, I would just nuance that a bit. One is it's surprising that with 200 million Muslims in this country, so they're a very sizable minority, that there isn't a national political party for the Muslims. There's Congress, who are the opposing party, but they are basically just a secular anti-Modi party who have ruled India. But I'm surprised they don't have their own political voice that is specifically for Indian Muslims. I don't know why that is. And actually, Muslims that I've spoken to are remarkably mellow. From Hindus, a lot of them don't like Modi, but there's a general sense in which India's doing quite well economically. He's doing well with road building. I mean, it's a bit that Mussolini made the trains run on time, to be honest. There's a slight sense from the middle class that, yeah, we don't like him, we don't like his racism, but he's making the country work.
I think because Indian Muslims consider themselves to be Indian and Muslim. And I think that their concept of nationhood is really strong. Yeah. I see even amongst British Indian Muslims who still talk about their Indian heritage and their Indian nationality. And I'm incredibly proud of the fact that they took a decision to remain in India at the point of partition. I think in a way it's good that there isn't a national Muslim party that represents the Muslim voice and that they are part of a broader Congress predominantly, which is representative of all faiths and none in India. The concerning bit for me is that in a community of nearly 15% of India, there are, I think they're less than 5% of representation within parliament. Right. That's the worrying that are they actually being represented? And the fact that the BJP, the ruling party, which rules across large parts of India and holds overwhelmingly the power, that there isn't a single Muslim parliamentarian is really deeply disturbing.
Yeah, that's obviously wrong. When I had this big revelation, which turns out not to be a revelation, that the way that Pakistan was created was a bit like the way that Israel was created, I then thought, I wonder how more pro-Zionist than me Jews would use that information. They would say, I presume, that very few people, or certainly no one I can think of on the left, would ever say that Pakistan does not have a right to exist, or I've never heard Pakistan, in fact, referred to as an ethno-state, or any sense of it being a racial idea that Pakistan is Pakistan. So what's your view on that, that it does share some of those characteristics, some of those founding principles, but doesn't get the same kind of, certainly not the same kind of stick as regards the idea of it as a country for one particular ethnicity?
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry to disappoint you that you're finally, you know, you thought this was a revelation. But Jonathan Friedland and I spoke about this very subject a few years back. And the reason
can you not refer to other Jews that you're talking to about Israel-Palestine, please? It's very hurtful for me.
I just need you to know that you're not my first Jew love, David. So basically, we talked about this at the time because we were trying to, the conversation we had was, how do you talk about Israel and Palestine? And for me, it's not just about talking to Jews, but actually me talking to Muslims to say, try and see this in different ways. So there's definitely read across about the fact that this was in the 1940s, this was a division of land, that this was in relation to a specific religious minority, that this was at the time of a British colonial setup, that this was screwed up on the way out, that this is unfinished business. And there's even read across actually to modern day what is happening, the relationship between Israel and India, the way in which some of the rhetoric that we see, nationalist rhetoric that we see in Israel, overlaps with nationalist rhetoric in India. And actually, recently during the war, there was an overlap because it said that some of the most anti-Palestinian and anti-Muslim rhetoric that was coming out in favor of Israel was actually coming out of India. But actually, there are differences as well. And I think this is also important to stress. First of all, the difference is that there wasn't a large movement of people, say, from Europe or elsewhere that came to those lands. So there was no mass migration from Europe and other places. Secondly, and if you speak to families, and I know families who actually did land swaps, house swaps, and interestingly, business swaps. So you had big industrialist families who were going to move across the border, and they said, you can take our manufacturing facility and our factory and business, and we'll take yours. So although there was a huge amount of bloodshed and a huge amount of killing and a huge amount of loss, there was also a level of arrangement. What it did do is it created two states with two governments and two armies. Whereas actually with Israel and Palestine, you didn't end up with two states and two governments and two armies. You ended up with one state and then this kind of alternative non-recognized state still by most parts of the world. Interestingly, India and Pakistan are both nuclear powers, but actually with Israel and Palestine, only Israel has military power, including nuclear power. India and Pakistan are both recognized states and have been since the 1940s. With Israel and Palestine, only one is recognized, for example, by the United States and the United Kingdom. So there are differences. The kind of job not yet finished is far greater in Israel and Palestine than it is in India and Pakistan.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. That's definitely true in terms of the recognition that you were talking about. There are differences. I think there are some similarities. I mean, I'm sort of mainly interested in the whole idea, because I think Israel, in terms of the way that the left tend to characterize it at the moment, there is this sense in which the founding principle of Israel is considered to be suspect on the left. And the founding principle seems to be similar, because it comes from an idea of security, out of an idea of ethnic security. Now, yeah, some of the people who were in Israel at the time of the partition of Israel had not been there for that long, but some of them had been there for a long time. And as we know, some of them came from other Middle Eastern places as well, felt whatever connection they felt to the land anyway. So the fact that it was screwed up is similar. And it just never occurred to me at all that the very idea, that one of the things on the IHRA document is that it's supposed to be anti-Semitic to call Israel, like the foundation of Israel, a racist idea because it's a Jewish state, and that's considered to be anti-Semitic on the IHRA document. And I would say the students in Colombia at present would certainly be very happy to contravene that regulation of the IHRA. But I can't imagine any of them saying that because Pakistan was set up to secure the security of Muslims, and that involved a lot of people being killed and a lot of people being displaced or whatever, they would never question the validity of Pakistan as a nation, given all the differences. Why does no one ever say, does Pakistan have a right to exist? Because it was founded by the same basic principle of a state for a particular race or a particular ethnic minority. It's actually that tenet of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism that most left-wing people question.
Yeah, that is right.
Most left-wing people, I would say, question that one, that it says you're not allowed to say, or it's anti-Semitic to say, that the establishment of the state or that the state of Israel conceptually is a racist idea.
Yeah. So I think this is where Pakistan, and actually I would say Israel, have fundamentally failed. Because although originally both of them were created as a safe haven for Jewish communities or Muslim communities, Israel, Pakistan, respectively, what they were also created as was states that were not going to impact on the rights of other people, including minorities. So if you look at Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, one of his earliest speeches at the creation of Pakistan was very clear. Go to your temples, go to your churches, the state has no, go to your mosques, the state has no involvement, interference with effectively which God and which faith you follow. And what has happened over time, both in Pakistan, which I think has been a massive regressive step, and we've seen it, of course, in Israel as well, is that the move towards a much more right-wing religious society has meant that the space for minorities has been increasingly difficult, to the point where now, openly, if you look at Israel, for example, you know, what they're saying is this is just a Jewish national state, and there is now primacy of Jewish people in that state. I think that, I suppose the slight difference is, and I think it goes back to what I was talking about in terms of differences, was that Pakistan wasn't created as a place for all Muslims around the world, just as a safe haven for Muslims. It was created as a land for the South Asian Muslims, i.e. for people who live in that land. And therefore, it's very different to, say, what happened with Israel, where you ended up with European Jews coming there and saying, we have a greater right to this land based upon a religious text from thousands of years ago, as opposed to this was a land created for specific people from these lands.
But that isn't just what happened. The vast majority of people there were refugees and had nowhere else to go because of the Holocaust. And the other 20% were refugees from Arab lands, coming there from other Arab lands because of, essentially, the anti-Jewish apartheid that exists and continues to exist, I would say, in most of those
Arab
lands.
I think that's the better example, David. That the probably the better correlation to draw is Jews who left Arab lands around there. So, you know, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, around
Iran,
the area. And then moved to Israel because it was a safe place.
I have watched a few people talk in general kind of correctly about how the Israel-Palestine conflict has drawn a wedge and shown us sort of the way that we are riven now, to some extent, between the global south and the West. It's slightly odd geographically, but basically the global South and the sort of European American West. And there's obviously some truth about that. And the vast majority of the global South do support Palestine. But you're right, India supports Israel. And by the way, as far as I can make out, not just politically, i.e. people here quite like Israel. All the people that I've spoken to, they're not massive pro-Zionists. In fact, it's only here, it's the only other country I've been to apart from kind of America, where non-Jews are quite keen to say, yeah, but what happened on October the 7th was really terrible and I think it's been forgotten and blah, blah, blah. And it's interesting that, because there's a lot of people. If Indians could be considered to be vaguely on the side of Israel, that's a lot of people in the global south who don't quite fit that equation.
I don't know what the polling is in India, but there is no doubt that the BJP government and Modi has pivoted towards
It's honestly not just the BJP. Not just the BJP. I get the feeling on the ground that people are generally, without being at all as committed on either side as they are in London or whatever, generally fairly well disposed towards Israel.
Listen, I'm going to take your word for it. You're in India at the moment and you're having these conversations. But I think what we do have to remember is that the pivot towards Israel is very recent. The pivot between the relationship between India and Israel has grown under a BJP right-wing nationalist government. And I think most people will say that Modi and Netanyahu are really exactly the same in terms of their political outlook and their nationalism and to some extent extreme religious positions. And that also there is this relationship between India and Israel, a military relationship. And India buys $2 billion worth of arms from Israel every year. And that accounts for about 46% of Israel's arms exports. So there is definitely a relationship. And you'll remember that really interesting, very odd bromance photo of Netanyahu and Modi walking along a beach in Tel Aviv. And it was a real kind of moment of saying, we are these big, strong, ideological men and we're working together. I think the stronger point to make, which I think is important, is in 2023, tracking anti-Muslim hate speeches by politicians and people in public life found that nearly 2 anti-Muslim hate speeches were being put out per day, and 75% of them were from states ruled by the BJP. But what was interesting was after the 7th of October attack, 1 in 5 of those anti-Muslim hate speeches invoked Israel and what happened on the 7th of October as a reason for their Islamophobic tropes. But I think what I worry about, And I think this is something that we need to address as British Muslims and as British Jews. What I worry about is the playing out of that extreme Modi, extreme Netanyahu relationship in London and in the United States, because it has a real impact on politics. And the relationship between Modi right-wing nationalism and the Conservative Party and Modi right-wing nationalism and the Republican Party and both of their relationship with the Netanyahu right-wing government is really disturbing. And we've seen it, I've seen it at the heart of the Conservative Party with the way in which political campaigns are run. And so we saw it during the mayoral election of Zach Goldsmith, where he actually put a photograph of himself shaking hands with Modi on his leaflet alongside a photograph of Jeremy Corbyn and Sadiq Khan to say them lot over there and us lot over here. There's also been this very odd relationship between Conservative Member of Parliament Bob Blackman, who's hosted extreme right-wing Hindu nationalists in Parliament, a chap called Tapan Ghosh, but has also been involved in retweeting Tommy Robinson. So there's a really unhealthy relationship with far-right extreme nationalism in India and far-right white nationalism in the United Kingdom and the politics of all of that. And most recently, we saw it play out, for example, in Leicester, when there were disturbances between British Hindus and British Muslims. And there was a suggestion, there's still an inquiry ongoing, but there was a suggestion that that was linked to groups that were affiliated with the BJP in India.
Yeah. Yes, no, I remember that. It's very recently that there have been riots in Delhi, in which a lot of people died. And it's sort of remarkable, in a way, that the situation here doesn't feel more tense, given the laws that are being passed, the nationalism that's being whipped up, and how recent those really murderous riots were.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Talking in a different way about religion and how it's used in politics, have a listen to this.
Are you familiar with Genesis 12:3?
Probably not as well as you are, Congressman.
Well, it's pretty clear. It was a covenant that God made with Abraham. And that covenant was real clear. If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you. And then in the New Testament, it was confirmed that all nations would be blessed through you. So you do not know about that.
I have heard that. Now that you've explained it, yes,
so
I have heard that
it's
before.
It's now familiar. Do you consider that a serious issue? I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, that's good.
So those voices that you heard there was Rick Allen, who is a Republican congressman. And the woman's voice you can hear is Columbia President Minush Shafiq, Columbia University, where, as you probably know, there are an awful lot of pro-Palestinian protests going on at the moment, and it's all going off quite intensely there. But that was some kind of congressional hearing. And the reason I think we're playing it is that Rick Allen is demonstrating there a very weird strand of American thought and American politics called Christian Zionism. Now, I know a little bit about this, and it's a very long and weird history, but the basic thing is that for a while, going back to the 16th century, there's a strand in Christian thinking that thinks once the Jews have returned to Israel, I think all the Jews, then the clock starts ticking, the sort of spiritual midnight clock starts ticking, and there are 7 years from then to the return of Jesus. And that is one reason why a huge block of evangelical Christians who vote in American elections and some people who are senators and in Congress have, whether they're not Jewish, and generally they aren't Jewish, some very, very powerful feelings about Israel. One of the things about Christian Zionists, which they often don't make entirely clear in their support for Israel, is that they are committed to the idea that in this prophecy, the Jews will all convert to Christianity. So it's not as pro-Jewish a stance as they might perhaps like to think.
And it proves, David, that every religion has its nutcases. And whether you have people like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or whether you have people like the RSS, or whether you have people like the extremist Zionist settler movement, or whether you have these extreme Christian Zionists, there are always people who think that these religious texts need to be taken literally, literally, and need to be used literally in today's world. And it actually sounds like it's bonkers. And I think what's disturbing is that, look, people have always had interesting literalist religious views in all religions and continue to do so. It's when they get their hands on the levers of power that it then starts to become really, really disturbing. And if you look at the numbers, for example, one of the largest Christian Zionist groups, the Christians United for Israel, claims to have about 10 million members. And it's the largest pro-Israel advocacy group in the United States. There are more Christian Zionists than there are Jewish Zionists by a number of 1 to 30. I think for every one Jewish Zionist, there are 30 yeah. Christian Zionists.
Well, you have to always remember how even in America, how few Jews there are in the world. There's 15 million Jews in the world, which is so few. It's a tiny minority. So in any situation, there's going to be basically more Christians or whatever. So even Christians, yes, who consider themselves to be Zionists, there's going to be many more of them than Jews. But it's an extraordinary thing, which I became most aware of actually during Trump's presidency, because it seemed to be obvious that Trump had quite a lot of issues with Jews. There's quite a famous speech, which I think I was watching when it happened, some Jewish organization he goes to speak at, and he just does a lot of anti-Semitic stereotyping, just does a lot of jokes about you'll all be good deal makers and you'll all be sharks and you'll all probably... He essentially characterizes them as a bunch of terrible moneylenders. But it doesn't matter to Trump that much, because he might want the Jewish support, but the Jewish support isn't that big. What he wants is the Christian evangelical support, because the Christian evangelical support is very, very wedded to this idea of a powerful, a strong Israel that Jesus will return to. I mean, it seems, I find it hard to say those words out loud, to imagine that they actually have geopolitical resonance.
I think this is the disturbing part of it, David. You're absolutely right that the deep-rooted anti-Semitic trope at the heart of this Christian Zionist restorationist project, as it was originally called, which is about let's get all the Jews to go to this promised land, and when they get there, they will either convert to Christianity or we'll kill them all off and then we'll have the second coming, is really disturbing. And the fact that you're quite right, again, when you talk about Trump, because at the heart of the Trump team, at the heart of the presidency, there were people like, oh, sorry, that's your room service, David. Tell me, it was the turndown service.
Yeah, it's a turndown service.
I do not like.
I can. Why I want that? Do I want a turndown service? I always think.
I completely agree with you. I have never worked out what is the point of a turndown service?
Yeah, what is the point? And anyway, if there's no chocolate on the pillow, which I don't think there is, really, just forget it.
So let me go back to this Trump thing, right? So basically, interestingly, right, okay. You're absolutely right about Trump, right? Because at the heart of his team were some really interesting people inspired by Christian Zionist beliefs, like Mike Pence, his former vice president, Mike Pompeo, his former Secretary of State, and also Steve Bannon, his chief strategist. All of these three men identified as Christian Zionists and really shaped what was Trump's policy eventually in relation to Israel and Palestine.
No, that's absolutely right. I don't really know that Biden... I get the sense with Biden that Biden's emotional support for Israel, which he does have, is not to do with that, that it's to, even though he's a Christian, as all American presidents have to be Christians, obviously, but it's to do with being old enough to remember the war, or certainly just after the war. And so he has a kind of old person's feel for the idea of Israel as a sanctuary from the most terrible things that might be done to Jews. But there may be people in Biden's government and who've got elements of Christian Zionism to them. What do you know?
I don't know if it is as overt as it was in a Trump presidency, but I think one of the things we have to remember is that at the very origins of the establishment of what we now know as the United States was that those early Christians that went to the United States were very much influenced by this kind of restorationist view, this kind of Christian Zionist view.
Yeah.
Because Christian Zionism predates Jewish Zionism by centuries. So centuries before people like Theodore Herzl, the gentleman who's recognized as the founder of Zionism, were talking about and were establishing the first. You've been doing a documentary on this, David, actually. So it'd be really interesting to hear what you found out about Theodore Herzl, because he has a very interesting relationship with Christian Zionism.
Does he? Because Herzl's not really very religious, and Herzl's attitude towards the need for a Jewish state is entirely about the sense that Jews are not secure. He sees the beginnings in Austria and Vienna of a German anti-Semitic nationalism. That's when he begins to think that there is a need for Jews to have a land. He himself wasn't very committed to it being in Israel-Palestine, but there were enough early Zionists that were. But I always think that's very interesting that the founding principle, even before the Holocaust, of the State of Israel was a sense that the Jews are not safe without some sort of sanctuary, which, to be honest with you, I think is at the heart of why Jews are attracted to the idea of Israel, and also at the heart of why, to some extent, it's in a dysfunctional position as regards its existence. Can I just say something which I think we should note, by the way, which is we're talking about this term Christian Zionists, and there are an awful lot of Christians, actual Christian Zionists in America. What there are more of are just people who identify as evangelical Christian or as people who believe in the Bible and in the literal word of the Bible. And according to a survey in 2003, more than 60% of evangelical Christians agree that the existence of Israel fulfilled biblical prophecy. So that's a huge block in America, isn't it? As you say, Christian Zionists are a pretty big block. But evangelical Christians, that's a huge amount of people.
Yeah, it is. And actually, again, the polling amongst Christians about the fact that God gave Israel to the Jewish people is far stronger than the polling amongst American Jews who think God gave Israel to the Jewish people. So this belief of it being a religious prophecy and a land given to these people is a much stronger held belief, actually, within Christians than it is amongst Jews. But I think what's really fascinating is you're absolutely right about Herzl, and actually even people like Moses Montefiore, the president of the British Board of Deputies in the late 1800s, didn't really take on this concept of Christian Zionism early on. They were more concerned, certainly Montefiore was more concerned about the space for Jews within Europe and the United States. They felt that these were their lands rather than this kind of Zionist land somewhere else. What they saw them as, and certainly Herzl did, was just a convenient relationship to allow him to achieve his ends. And he does recognize very early on in the first Zionist Congress that he held in Basel.
It was 1896. I was just there. I was in his room. I stayed in his room, which he's got a little plaque in it at the hotel that overlooks a bridge. So Herzl was quite a narcissist, and he brought a photographer with him to take photos of him musing about the creation of the Jewish state over the Rhine. But anyway, so I stayed in that room, and I recreated that photograph for this documentary that I'm doing.
You have to send it through to me. But one of the things he says, Herzl, in that very first kind of Zionist Congress, is that we must thank the Christian Zionists. He recognises and acknowledges the role that they've played for hundreds of years, long before Herzl came to this debate and discussion.
So what I think is that politically, maybe from Herzl, I don't actually know that much about that, but certainly all the way to Netanyahu, there is Zionist politicians who are very, very happy to accept the support or Christian Zionists, or evangelical Christians who believe in the State of Israel as some kind of miraculous force, because it means that this is a much, again, it's to do with the smallness of the Jewish community. They are a much larger block than Jews. And if, for whatever reason, without doubt, pragmatically, in terms of realpolitik, there will be Zionist politicians, Netanyahu amongst them, who will think very happy to accept the support of evangelical Christians. I think that's problematic. I think it will always be problematic because my sense is that evangelical Christians have no real interest in Jews. In fact, have little sympathy with Jews. Some of them may talk about God's chosen people, but quite famously, there's a very outspoken Christian Zionist called John Hagee.
So he's the chairman of the Christians United for Israel.
He said that Hitler had been sent by God. He believed Hitler had been sent by God because the Holocaust, through a series of steps, terrible steps, creates Israel. Without the Holocaust, it's unlikely that we would have a state of Israel. But that's a man who doesn't really care about Jews. Mm-hmm. He cares about prophecy. Mm-hmm. I find nothing offensive. I am an unoffendable person, and I'm quite close to being offended by John Hagee saying God sent Hitler to create Israel.
It's a deep anti-Semitism. I think Jews... you're absolutely right, David. There is a deep anti-Semitism at the heart of this. So it wasn't actually about Jews. It was about Christians. And in that process, what the Jews were going to do was either convert to Christianity and learn the error of their ways, or they were going to be killed. And that was the way in which how this whole new era of Christianity was going to come.
Yeah, well, I think that when the Jews, that would include me, are finally every Jew, I believe, ends up in Israel, that's the time for Jesus to be triggered, to come back to Jerusalem, at which point we all recognise Jesus as our Lord. That's the key thing. Right.
But apparently, there is a belief, David, that some of the Jews will convert to Christianity before they go to those lands in waiting for that second coming. Right. And some of them, when they get there, will convert, and those that don't will be annihilated.
If I was in Israel with the 15 million Jews of the world for some reason, let's say we'd all gone there accidentally, and Jesus, having realised that we're there, comes back, I obviously, at that point, I would say, no, you didn't see, but I definitely became a Christian just 5 seconds before you turned
up. Muslims too are waiting for the second coming of Christ because they believe he's Muslim.
Right.
But what it doesn't involve, thankfully, is the annihilation of Jews for him to come. Thankfully. So you know what? If Jesus turns out to be Muslim, you're going to be all right, mate.
Yeah. So what this is about is erasing Jews. It's just using Jews essentially as a cipher, Jews as a passageway towards achieving what is a greater religious aim, which is the second coming. What will happen when Jesus comes back is the rapture will happen. And there's actually a sort of incredible selfishness going on, which is I think the American evangelical Christians think, right, once we've done this and all the Jews have converted to Christianity and Jesus has come back, I will be one of the saved.
Okay, so you know what I said right at the beginning, David, right? If people want to believe this stuff, go believe what the hell you want. But what worries me is when this becomes government policy of the most powerful nation in the world. And if you look at what happened during the last Trump presidency, there's a real belief in Christian Zionist beliefs that Israel will be vulnerable from attacks from the north, according to biblical prophecies. Therefore, what you found was that Trump recognized the Golan Heights as now an annexation and an integral part of Israel. And he did that, interestingly, at an AIPAC convention. Now, these are all the kind of weird bits that I think, surely, I mean, if I was Jewish and I was a supporter of Israel, a Jewish Zionist, surely I'm intelligent enough to work out that this is really mad stuff and these guys are not our friends.
Yes and no, I would agree with you. But I think I'm very much agreeing with you there as someone who's kind of a non-Zionist, i.e. someone who doesn't feel this stuff very emotionally. I think for Jews who do, I guess that they are able to do a double thing there, which is it's a bit weird and it's not very pro-Jewish the way that these Christians want to do this. But if it adds to Israel's security, and lots of Jews think controlling the Golan Heights does add to the security, then we're prepared to overlook their slightly weird reasons. And that's what they're doing. And I understand why they're doing that. They consider it to be expedient to their own sense of security. But obviously, yes, the motivations of the people are odd and, in fact, probably dysfunctional and certainly not very pro-Jewish. As far as I understand it, that's also partly why Trump tried to move the embassy to Jerusalem. His main reason for doing that was to appease or to gain the support of Christian Zionists. Because part of the New Testament prophecy or the evangelical prophecy is that Jerusalem will exist as the undisputed capital of Israel. And that's definitely in Donald Trump's thinking by moving the embassy there that he gains the support of Christian Zionists. The problem here is when magic, superstition, religion starts to affect foreign policy. And obviously the announcement that Jerusalem will be where the US embassy is extremely politically inflammatory and caused a lot of anger and controversy. And what I kind of think is, like, maybe there might have been a way in which, not Donald Trump because he's so terrible, but a way in which someone might have been able to appeal to me as a Jew as to why that was a good thing. But you're never going to appeal to me as a Jew if I know at heart you're doing it because you want baby Jesus to come back. That's never going to work.
But can you see from my perspective why I think it's very ISIS-like? Because they took this literal interpretation of the Quran. They established this Islamic, inverted commas, state, that this was the beginning of the end times, that these were the righteous chosen people, and this is where Islam was going to spread out from. And to me, it was absolute bonkers. It was why the vast majority of Muslims around the world thought they were absolutely bonkers. And that the fact that this crazy interpretation of the way in which they saw things was rejected, and this was then going to be the basis of their engagement with the world. If we can be bold enough to say, as we did quite rightly, ISIS guys, you're mad, and this is a mad interpretation of so-called inverted commas, Muslim belief, we should be just as bold as saying to Christians and Jews who have these mad beliefs that actually this is a crazy view and it can't form the basis of how modern states operate and modern foreign policy operates. And what for me is fascinating, David, is that if you go back through history, British Jewry and American Jewry were not supportive of this. And even when in history, there was an incident where Colonel Charles Churchill, a resident British officer in Damascus, reached out in June 1841 to Moses Montefiore, who was president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. And he pushed back because he thought that this restorationist approach was wrong in terms of making Jews from the UK move back to this kind of promised land. He thought it was good to support Jews who were in Palestine, but he didn't see it as a reflection of what British Jews should be doing in terms of moving to Israel. So it was rejected by Jewry in the early days.
The whole creation of the Zionist movement in the 19th century, there were lots and lots of assimilated diaspora Jews who were very against the creation of a Jewish state because they felt, not completely incorrectly, this is a very interesting nuance, they felt that there's something anti-Semitic about that because it implies that Jews cannot live in other societies and that the other societies will always reject Jews. Now, unfortunately, certainly that turned out to be true in Europe, but there were very intellectual assimilated Jews who didn't want to accept that and felt that it had, you know, self-hating roots to some extent in the Zionist project. One of the things we try to talk about a lot is the differences between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and I guess between Zionism as an idea and Jewishness as an idea, right? And I would say if you wanted to see that there is a difference, Christian Zionism is quite a good way of seeing it. And the fact that some Zionists do support Christian Zionism is a way of seeing it. Because I would say my Jewishness revolts against the idea of Christian Zionism, against any use of Christianity in which the Jews are pawns as part of a greater Christian project. But there are some Jews for whom Zionism and the idea of there being a safe space for Jews, which is in their mind what Zionism is about, then they're prepared to blend in what is a very jarring thing, which is the Christian Zionist thing, into that ideal.
David, I, as somebody who is of faith, and I don't like to mock faith, and I like to treat people's religion with respect.
I do.
Yeah, but I think...
I like to mock faith.
Yeah. I know you do, but I try not to, but there comes a moment, doesn't there?
Where I know, you do well.
There comes a moment when you just look at them around the world and whether they're ISIS Muslims or RSS Hindus or settler Jews or Christian Zionists, you just got to turn around and say, you are nuts, guys, and it's often guys.
I mean, one thing about Britain, right, is it's a screwed up country with all sorts of things wrong with it, but I beyond Jacob Rees-Mogg occasionally putting on Twitter on Easter, he is risen, I don't think you get really mad religious stuff happening within government, do you?
I think there is more extreme religious stuff happening in government now than there has been in the past. But the thing about...
Is there?
Yeah, I mean, I have colleagues on some of our benches now who have some interesting beliefs. But actually what is good about the British system is that even though we have bishops in the House of Lords, that they are actually part of our parliamentary process and our legislature, it is actually a really measured way in which religion gently runs along. And we have a very clear secular system and a recognition that actually we do, although we are a Christian heritage country, we're not a theocracy. And that's not the basis upon which we make laws.
So I thought we could finish.
Yeah, go on.
I thought we could finish by since I am leaving India and you're arriving in Pakistan, we should probably do a tiny bit of language, do you think?
Yeah, I have a word for you, which is, and I'm probably going to pronounce it completely wrong, because in light of all this conversation about Christian Zionism, I felt that the one thing that is missing in Christian Zionism is Sehul. Sehul?
Yeah, what is that? Is that Jewish?
It's a Hebrew word for good sense and common sense.
Oh. It will be Yiddish.
It's Sehol.
Okay, I've never heard of that. And I'm going to tell you now, Google Translate hasn't heard of it either.
It's in the book called The Joys of
Fine,
Yiddish.
Yes. No, look. My parents had that book and I used to quite like dipping into it from time to time because it's actually a very sweet book. So I'm going to agree with you that Christian Zionists need a dose of Sehol. It's probably not pronounced like that. It's probably Sehol or something, isn't
it? Apparently it rhymes with playful.
It rhymes with playful? Yeah. Sehol. Okay. Okay. When I leave India, though, what should I say in terms of goodbye to... How many languages do you speak, Saida?
I speak English and Yorkshire and Urdu and Arabic and
is
Punjabi and a little bit of Gujarati.
There's bound to be a Punjabi somewhere at the airport. If I was to wave to them and say goodbye, how would that be?
Punjabis can be Hindu, Punjabis can be Sikh, Punjabis can be Muslim, and they may use their religious word rather than their Punjabi word. But if it's a Sikh, you could just say Sat Sri Akal, which is
That's hard. Say it again.
So, Sat Sri Akal.
Sat Sri Akal.
Yeah, there you go. Really well done. Which is a kind of a greeting.
So thank you very much for listening. So next week, A Muslim and a Jew Go There will be doing another Q&A episode where we answer your questions.
The email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com or you can send them in via Twitter @AMuslimAndAJew.
A Muslim and a Jew Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.